Good afternoon. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Bernard Ouellette. After the fatal shooting in the jungle last January, a City of Seattle staffer met with the mother of one of the survivors. KUOW obtained an email that recounts that conversation. The mother said her daughter had been homeless a long time, and she'd been unable to get into shelters or housing for one reason or another. That's part of the problem, and part of the reason the jungle exists. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols has more.
She was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She'd returned to the jungle to pick up her suitcase when the shooters arrived. Her suitcase. When you're homeless, a suitcase like that might contain everything you own in this world. You either keep it with you, or you have to trust someone to keep an eye on it. It's easier to keep your stuff in the jungle than it is to keep it with you in a shelter. Liz Worley Prieto manages the Downtown Emergency Services Center. It's a shelter. Everybody just calls it the DESC. She takes me through the day room.
So this is just an area where people can get inside and rest.
People sit on chairs, their personal belongings gathered around their feet.
Where do people put their stuff?
So we ask that all clients keep their belongings with them at all times, and that's really challenging for folks because a lot of people don't have, you know, nice backpacks or things like that, so they may have all their belongings with them in a trash bag.
The shelter just doesn't have room to store all that. It's the same story at other shelters. That's one of the reasons Cassidy Sweezy lives in the jungle. She goes to the methadone clinic nearby. She has a tidy encampment behind a section of chain-link fence under the freeway. It's a sort of home where she can cook and relax in privacy.
To stay in a shelter, you have to carry all your belongings and leave at a certain time and come back to wait in line to get in at another certain time, and there's nowhere to cook. And I've got a boyfriend, I've got two dogs, which also doesn't fly.
It's what you carry with you that makes you who you are.
I kind of gave up on the system a little while ago because you jump through all these hoops and they ask so much of you.
The things she carries, they make her life better.
For me to, like, move to a shelter and go that route, it would really, like, degrade my way of living right now. It would be like taking a step back.
Rick Reynolds is a homeless advocate with Operation Nightwatch. He gets what Sweezy is talking about. He says when you go into a shelter, you give up a lot, like some personal freedoms.
I mean, you know, shelter's going to regiment you, and human beings defy regimentation. Any parent of a teenager will understand this.
Teddy Murata Jr. is selling single cigarettes outside the DESC. He points to the shelter.
That place there is the most ridiculous, outlandish place I've ever been to.
Murata got kicked out after his mental health issues flared up and resulted in a knife fight. He also uses crack. It shows what a complicated population shelters work with, and the other kind of baggage shelter clients sometimes carry with them. So, do shelters even work? Yes, they work for many people, according to Sola Plumacher. She's with Seattle's Human Services Department and in charge of contracts with shelters. She says we need more of them, but at the same time, she recognizes shelters only address a symptom rather than the root of the problem.
It has definitely become very clear in the last 5 years that that is not the kind of system that is having the greatest impact.
A 2012 internal report criticized the way the city spends its money fighting homelessness. It said we spend 70% on shelters and temporary housing, and only 30% on cheaper strategies that work better, like rental assistance or permanent housing with counseling. Data obtained by KUOW suggests things haven't changed that much since the report came out. City staffer Josh Hall was the report's author. He compares the shelter system to a drinking glass held under a water tap. You can make the glass taller so the water doesn't overflow.
Or you can figure out a way to turn off the tap, slow the tap, and then you don't need to keep building up that glass to hold and contain the water.
So why hasn't the city been able to shift funding into more cost-effective strategies? The report blames lack of political will and the influence of advocates who depend on funding to stay in business. The city wants to change that. Sola Plumacher says at some point, shelters in Seattle may compete against each other for contracts, and they may be judged based on how well they succeed in getting people into more stable situations. They've hired a consultant to help them with those kinds of decisions. But homeless advocate Rick Reynolds argues We shouldn't judge shelters too harshly for the things they can't do.
Shelter itself has value. You're reducing human suffering, right? You're keeping people engaged with other human beings in a semi-responsible way. You know, they're able to get along with others and they can function in the shelter system, and that's a good thing.
Reynolds says what we really need is affordable housing for the poorest people in our community. Meanwhile, the city is moving on its plan to get people out of the jungle. Outreach workers are trying to persuade people to accept shelter. Cassidy Sweezy says she won't take that offer. She plans to just camp somewhere else, probably in a place that's more visible than the jungle.
I think that even if you just fenced us out, we would just be in your face more. We're not going to go anywhere. We're not going to disappear because you take where we sleep at night away.
In the jungle, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
Well, as you just heard, Seattle's homeless shelters don't work for some people. Shelters have curfews, rules about no pets and no partners, and no place to store your things. What if we changed our shelter system and tried to remove some of those barriers? That's what one shelter in San Francisco is doing. Julie Ledbetter directs the Navigation Center. She told KUOW's Bill Radke how that center is doing things differently than how we do them here in Seattle.
The Navigation Center is different in two main ways. One is that we are a very low threshold shelter. So what that means is that we lower all barriers to access that we possibly can. So there's no curfew. People can come and go as they please. They can bring their pets. They can bring their possessions. And they can sleep together with their partners. That's one aspect of it. That's our low threshold approach. The other piece that's critical and sometimes a little bit invisible is the navigation component, which is about coordinating our city systems in order to serve the client. So we streamline access to housing and to benefits, which gives people a huge jump start on the housing process.
Well, if you can accommodate people's partners and pets and possessions, why doesn't Seattle do it? Why doesn't every shelter do that?
It's hard to do. In order to accommodate people's belongings, we have to provide that level of support. So we go out with Public Works and pick up people with all of their stuff. We might, some days when we pull an encampment in, we might have a whole packer truck load full of belongings. And then we store all that stuff in these big containers outside. So we have the space to do that particular accommodation. Other people might not.
Okay, so you have room for people's stuff. How do you handle the obvious problems that come with allowing partners in? It's men and women and partners. Have you had problems with danger, violence, unpredictable interactions there?
I mean, you know, we all have our moments with our partners, so there's definitely, squabbles and arguments and just like any other subset of the population, it can sometimes get a little complicated. But for the most part, we're providing a very rare service of helping this couple to navigate a system that's really fundamentally designed for single people. And oftentimes it's a lot easier because what you're doing is you're bringing people in the way they want to exist. You're bringing their support network in. So as long as you are creating a space in which you're really helping people solve their problems, they are happy to be here, engaged, and ready to do the work.
How do you let people bring in their pets and still have, still let folks get a good night's sleep?
I was nervous to have such a pet-focused program. I didn't know what that was going to look like. And in the end, it's been one of the easiest things. The pets are very well socialized. They sleep with their owners in their beds. If they have any behavioral issues, we treat it just like any other behavioral issue. We get a ton of support from animal care and control. We offer husbandry clinics. We have muzzles if they need them, cages if they need them. But it's been an aspect that brings a lot more healing and well-being than it detracts in any sort of chaos or things that don't work.
You had Seattle's mayor and city council members come to San Francisco to learn from you. What do we need to learn?
No, I don't know the particulars of Seattle in terms of what their challenges are, but, I can speak to challenges here. And I think some of the barriers in the past for shelters have been policymaking. Some of the policymaking, we've actually encouraged them over the last years to move away from models like this. Sometimes People have been very low threshold models already, and we encourage them to put more rules in place. Some of it is simply having the right resources. So if we want to do a 24-hour shelter, you have to pay for 24 hours. And it's expensive compared to other shelters, but it's necessary because we're helping clients who have been on the streets the longest, who have complex problems, and it's an appropriate intervention, an appropriate use of resources. So there's a lot of constraints that you have to work with, but I think if everybody's committed, you can make it happen. I think it's also just a little bit of fear sometimes, you know. We're very used to certain things, like having gender segregated a men's floor, a women's floor, things like that. But when you see it in action and you see that it works a different way, it makes all the difference.
We're talking with Julie Ledbetter, who directs this shelter we're talking about called the Navigation Center in San Francisco, where they lower the barriers for entry, the barriers that keep some Seattle homeless folks out of shelters. What have you learned through running this center, Julie?
I have learned that a lot of people out there still think there is this idea of service resistance, where people don't want help or they prefer a homeless lifestyle. And, you know, doing this work for many, many years, I do not believe that, but I had sort of forgotten how many people do believe that. And I think it's the Navigation Center has been a wonderful model to show that it's not about resisting services. It's really about how you design your services and what kind of access you provide to people. And when those things are in place, people are very willing to make major changes in their lives.
Julie Ledbetter is the director of the Navigation Center in San Francisco. In a little more than a year, the shelter has served close to 500 people. Ledbetter says most people, about 4 out of 5 of them, have moved on to more permanent housing. Here in Seattle, officials are looking at whether a shelter like Navigation Center, low barrier, open all day, could work here. And we asked how you would change Seattle's homeless shelter system. Here's what you told us.
My name is Sunita, and I'm calling from Seattle. As someone who had to call repeatedly looking for a bed and never once found one, I think that an app would actually be a great way to solve a lot of problems. If you had an app, people could actually report directly in real time that they have a bed available, and people could receive the information who are in that area.
This is Joanna Shuttler from West Seattle. Why don't we just put some showers, public service and stuff on the outskirts of the jungle? People can go in and out. And then we need to start building lower-income housing.
My name is Rebecca Snowlanda. I'm calling from North Seattle. And first of all, we need a lot more shelters. And we need some shelters that allow people to use their drugs until, you know, they're ready to go to treatment.
Some of your ideas about how to improve our shelter system. We'll continue to cover the issue of homelessness here on KUOW, along with the city's largest homeless camp, The Jungle. And we want you to be part of the discussion. KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols and some current and former residents will be at the downtown branch of the Seattle Public Library this Friday evening at 7 for a conversation about the future of The Jungle. You can find more information at our website, kuow.org. Vern McLeod grew up on the Swinomish Reservation here in Washington State, and like many kids, he hated going to the dentist. But McLeod had a good reason. When he was growing up, the dentist was a guy in a trailer who didn't bother with anesthetics. He just strapped his patients down and drilled. Now the Swinomish tribe wants to change the face of dental care on their reservation. But the way they're doing it breaks state law. New York Times reporter Kirk Johnson has written about the effort. He told KOW's Jeannie Yandel years of subpar care has meant poor oral health for the Swinomish tribe and on reservations around the country.
Unfortunately, I think there's a whole generation that got scarred by horrific care like that. You hear of that pattern in talking to people who track this issue around the country, that part of the reason things are so bad is that there was an older generation who instilled fear in their children and grandchildren, and it became an endemic problem.
So that's part of the reason things are so bad. What other reasons are there?
Well, it's a similar reason that you find in Appalachia or in other places. It's partly a rural story. It's partly a poverty story. Dentists like other professionals, are not clamoring to go where they're not going to make good livings. So what you have is a shortage of dentists for something like 2.5 million Native Americans. But then I think, as you say, it's compounded by a kind of a weird wrinkle of history that has made it worse, too.
Well, the Swinomish tribe has tried to take this head on, this issue of not having reliable dental care, of having poor oral health for its tribe members. So what have they decided to do?
They're making a stand. After 5 years of trying to get authority and approval from the Washington State Legislature to hire a dental therapist, which is a sort of mid-level professional, trained to do essentially most of what dentists do, and 5 years in a row of failing to pass a bill, the tribal leadership there said, we believe under tribal sovereignty, we have the right to do it ourselves. We're going to create a license to hire a dental therapist, and partly for our own benefit and the benefit of other Native Americans in that community, but just as much to send a message across to tribes everywhere to say, do this. Say the heck with whatever the authorities in your state are doing. You have the authority to do it. We are.
Why is that even a problem? Why are there state legislatures like Washington saying, no, you can't have dental therapists on your reservation? I mean, that seems like a pretty common sense thing to do. If you can't get dentists, bring in dental therapists who can help these folks.
You would think so. But legislation that passed, now incorporated into the Affordable Care Act, specifically requires that states need to grant authority to have this kind of middle-level care. Certainly, there are people in the tribal community and other parts of healthcare who say the American Dental Association got a sweetheart deal here and got an exclusionary language in there that blocked this. The Dental Association says it's about safety, that dentists are MDs and MDs do surgery, and filling a cavity is surgery, drilling a tooth is surgery, and it's just not safe to have someone who's not an MD. That's their position. I was struck by the dentist who works in the clinic up at Swinomish, who said, really what you need to look at here is not the MD degree, but how many times have they done the procedure? And the people who have been through these mid-level dental therapist programs, they just train extensively. They do the procedure over and over and over. And more than a typical dental graduate, she said, would have ever done, because at dental school, you know, you'll have to learn medical diagnosis and medical disease. And they don't, if you're a dental therapist, you work on the mechanics of doing this procedure. And she says, ultimately, their feelings are better, because they've done it so many more times. And so the argument of safety, to her mind, goes out the window.
Well, as you said, the Affordable Care Act doesn't allow for dental therapists to work in this way. So where is the tribe finding licensed dental therapists? Where are they finding these people to come work?
Currently, Alaska is the place you go. At that same window when the Affordable Care Act was being written, an act that covered only Alaska gave them authority to start this school. Before that time, they were sending students to New Zealand to study, to come back and work in these remote villages. And that's where you would get a dental therapist. Now, three states have authorized dental therapy programs within their states so far. Minnesota has one up and running. Vermont passed one this year. Maine passed one a few years ago, but has not really implemented it. So Minnesota is the only other state where there's an active therapist training program in effect, though none of those people are working on tribal lands at the moment.
The Swinomish decided to start this program and bring dental therapists onto the reservation to provide care. The dental therapist that the Swinomish tribe hired is from a tribe in Alaska. His name is Daniel Kennedy. What kind of response is Daniel getting from the Swinomish tribe?
as far as I could tell, overwhelmingly positive. I think people are responding, and the patients I talked to when I was there, responding very favorably to seeing a native face looking down on them when they get to the table. And I think part of that is really resonating, not just care and the quality of care or the belief that it's going to be good, but they walk in and they see Daniel, and I think they really like that. They want to see that, and it gives them confidence, I think, that as one of the patients put it to me, you know, he knows where we come from. He knows what we're about, and that feels right to me. But I think they're also intrigued and engaged by the idea of this stand that the tribe is making. Daniel says, you know, people come in and they want to talk about the politics of this too, that, you know, you're the guy with the controversial thing going on here, you know, and they're proud that their tribe is making this stand and saying, you know, we're doing it.
That's New York Times reporter Kirk Johnson talking with Jeannie Yandel. The stand that started here in Washington State is already having a ripple effect. Oregon has authorized a pilot project that will see 4 Native students training to be dental therapists this summer. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 12:31. Would you let your smartphone share your location if it meant that one day you could come to a stranger's rescue? In certain Northwest cities, including Seattle, 911 dispatch can now send out a mobile phone alert to citizen responders nearby when a person needs CPR in a public place. It's part of a new program called the Pulse Point Network. Spokane was one of the first cities in the region to participate. KOW correspondent Tom Bonsi reports on how it has already helped one Spokane family.
Karen Garrison went shopping with her children at a ballet store in Spokane. It was there her youngest child, baby Nolan, stopped breathing.
It was such a blur. Someone yelled to call 911. He's not breathing. He was blue. And
the shopkeeper immediately dialed for help.
I don't know CPR or anything. And so I just was holding him basically until I was assuming the ambulance would arrive first.
At that moment, about a block and a half away, master mechanic Jeff Olson was fixing a car at the Perfection Tire Garage. His smartphone squawked to life.
The phone went off. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. I wonder if it's another, like an Amber Alert or something like that. And I looked down and it said, CPR needed. It gave me an address and I'm going, wow, that's just short.
Way away. Olson knew that seconds count in such a situation. He moonlights as a volunteer EMT with an ambulance service north of Spokane. He says he washed his hands real quick and dashed to the scene.
And so I asked her, you know, what's going on, what's happening, and then scooped the baby and put him into my arm and started doing some rescue breathing for him.
Half a year before, Olson had downloaded a free smartphone app called Pulse Point. The app automatically notifies users when there's a cardiac emergency nearby. It's tied in to participating 911 dispatch centers. The idea is for citizen responders to start CPR when medics are still on the way.
So the more responders that we can get there that can switch out CPR and keep that person's blood pumping until we have professional responders there, the more likely that person is to survive.
Brian Schaefer is the assistant fire chief in Spokane. Spokane County and the Portland-Vancouver-Salem metro area are the first communities in the Northwest to adopt Pulse Point. The app was invented about 5 years ago by a fire chief from Northern California. Schaefer says in the Spokane area, the app triggers an alert to citizen responders within a quarter mile of an incident about 150 times per year. Some percentage of those make a life-saving difference, although the chief can't say exactly how many, because the Good Samaritans often disappear before they can be debriefed and thanked.
Anybody can be a rescuer. It is that simple. In fact, traditionally we used to teach CPR in fire stations. We don't even do that anymore. It's all on the internet.
Schaefer says in the case of baby Nolan, the nearest fire engine was on another call, so it took more than 5 minutes for medics to arrive. Citizen responder Jeff Olson and the Pulse Point app got credit for saving baby Nolan's life.
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
Olson didn't know the Garrison family before. They've become reacquainted under happier circumstances. Nolan's father, Michael Garrison, says the baby made a full recovery. Garrison now wants everyone at the coffee house he owns trained in CPR and signed up with PulsePoint.
This is the point of the app on your phone. It's not just Angry Birds. It's not just things to waste your life. It's actually a perfect example of a selfless app that's there to help other people.
I'm Tom Bonsi in Spokane.
And we are sharing information about the PulsePoint app with you right now on Twitter. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. And you know, we're not only on Twitter, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr. So let's get social, shall we? Speaking of getting social, tomorrow is First Thursday, the day when galleries and art museums in Seattle open their doors to the public for free. But with all that art on view and only one day, how do you pick what to see? That's why we have Stranger art critic Jen Graves. She came in to give two recommendations. They're both exhibitions by women artists. The first one has painted dogs. Really? Bill Radke asked her, dogs?
This is her first time painting dogs.
Oh.
In the past, she's painted dolls, another highly unpopular fine art subject. Sherry Markowitz is yes. at Greg Kucera Gallery.
Yeah, I've seen her doll paintings on cotton, right? Which
yes.
is a cool medium if you haven't seen it. The paint really sinks in.
That's so, yes. It's the dog paintings are really interesting because she manages to turn that cotton into like a depth of field, which she didn't really do with the doll. She wasn't that interested in it, but it's actually, these are from observation from walking to the dog park where she went with her dog until her dog died. And then she just kept taking the walk by herself. And she creates these scenes on this cotton that actually do look like you're sort of in this, you're looking at the dogs in their environment. They're not portraiting. They're doing their thing.
Now, I have to tell you, Jen, I'm one of those people who saying that there's going to be paintings of dogs is not going to get me through the door. I like dogs. I find depictions of dogs usually cloying.
Yes.
So talk to me about why I want to see somebody to pick dogs.
Oh, I so appreciate that. Well, I can say that in almost 20 years of doing this work, I have never before recommended a show of art about dogs, of dogs. So that should go toward your...
Okay.
I am also not a person who wants to recommend a show about dogs.
Okay.
But in this one, I think what's so interesting is she works so hard to present the dogs as these really complex, separate creatures. They're not projections of what she'd like them to be. They're, she catches them as best she can, is basically it. I mean, she is totally letting the dogs and their kind of quirks and the strange ways that dogs work. She's working from photographs that she makes from observation, and she's just really letting them try to appear. And you see her erasing on the cotton. You see the paint dripping and not really, like, the dog's edges kind of being blurred. And, like, you sense that she's barely in charge of making these depictions, which is really a powerful experience to feel from somebody who's been working for so long. She is an incredibly accomplished artist. And she's really letting go in this way. And the dogs are kind of in motion. And it's a surprise. Really.
Okay, so that show, Sherry Markowitz, has an opening reception at Greg Kucera Gallery, Pioneer Square, First Thursday.
Yes.
The next show you're recommending actually opens this Saturday, so not on First Thursday. It's at the Northwest African American Museum, and it's called 100% Kinekalon. And if you didn't get that reference immediately, Kinekalon is a kind of synthetic hair. Please tell me the show is entirely made out of fake hair.
The show is entirely made out of 100% fake hair. No, it's not.
Oh.
But it is about that brand, and it is about the branding that Tarika finds hilarious because it's fake hair, but it's 100%. No, so it's the
purely fake
hair. Yeah.
And who is Tarika?
Tarika Waters is the artist. The full title of the show is 100% Kinekalon, The Untold Story of the Marginalized Matriarch. And she's creating portraits, some in photographs, some in sort of pop art and branding pieces, and then a few surprises she's talked about. And when she first started doing this work, it was when she was being invited by Out of Sight last year during Seattle Art Fair to create work. And she kept being asked about being a person of color. And she was like, you know, I am a person of color, but I'm black. Like, I'm a black woman, and I want to make something that is really from my history. She's from D.C. She moved here a few years ago from Atlanta with her husband and two kids. And she created this photograph called 100% Kanekalon. And it was kind of in tribute to a childhood memory. She had a friend named Nikki, who was like a best friend of hers, who she lost. And Nikki had used to do her hair, and Nikki's mom. And they would shout out 100% Kanekalon in the studio or in the shop, in the barbershop. And, you know, and that was supposed to be like the best hair you could get, 100% Kanekalon. So it's definitely, she's kind of making fun of this brand of, you know, awesome hair.
And this artist, Tarika Waters, she's opening up, here we are back to First Thursday. She's opening up a space in Pioneer Square.
She is. She used to have a space called Martyr Sauce on Washington. It was just a stairwell. And now she's moving across Occidental Square, across to First and Jackson, to the site of the old Buds Records, I guess.
I remember Buds Records.
Okay, yeah. Good. And it's a basement
good
space.
Good spot.
Evidently. And she's going to have that space on a permanent basis. The first exhibition, nothing will be for sale. Her husband, Ryan, is a guitarist and had worked with Prince. And it will be some of the stuff that he's gathered over the years from working with Prince. And so it'll be just kind of fun and an introduction to the space.
Wow. When does that open?
That opens on First Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m.
Jen Graves is the art critic for The Stranger. She was talking with KUOW's Bill Radke. As we've been reporting here on KUOW, homelessness has hit crisis levels in Seattle. And north of our border, the number of people living on the streets in Vancouver, B.C. has hit a 10-year high. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer told Bill Radke what the problem looks like.
The most recent Vancouver number is 1,847 people without permanent housing, and that is a count done in March, and that is a 6% increase from last year.
We've talked, Vaughn, about your skyrocketing real estate prices there. Is that why homelessness is way up?
The only thing I think we've learned for sure, Bill, in the last few years, and I think it's been learned in San Francisco and Portland and Seattle and here in Victoria as well, is that it's a far more complicated problem than the politicians realized when they got into it. I mean, I can remember, I go to Portland a lot, and I can remember a few years back when politicians from up here were going down to Portland because they'd solved the homeless problem. Well, last time I was in Portland, they hadn't solved it. And Vancouver, yeah, I mean, yes, the real estate crisis in Vancouver has put a lot of pressure on low-income housing. Yes, there is the government funding issue for social housing. There is also a problem of putting homeless people into housing. Some of them do a lot of damage to that housing. The provincial government bought a bunch of low-end hotels in the Vancouver region, and there's been a lot of damage done to them by the single occupancy people living there. Last of all, and we've discovered this here in Victoria, Bill, is there are a bunch of people who actually don't want to go into shelters in this climate. You can live on the street, and they like the freedom of living in tent cities or living on the street. And so you put all that into the mix. Has anybody solved this problem anywhere in our region? I'm not sure they have.
Yeah, obviously, to our listeners, we've got, unfortunately, a lot in common here. Seattle has a big unauthorized tent camp known as the Jungle, a dangerous place, a place some people call home. Victoria has that flashpoint at its courthouse. What is the latest there?
Yeah, there's a tent city started outside the courthouse and outside one of our big cathedrals in Victoria on a vacant provincial government lot in downtown Victoria last fall. It has grown to alarming proportions. Violence, drugs, needles, neighbors infuriated because it's damaged their neighborhood. The church has given up on it and said, we try to be compassionate, but it's got to go. And the provincial government is going to court Friday to begin a process to evict the tent city. They've had enough. They say they've done enough to solve problems elsewhere. They've created beds, shelters, housing. They've done everything they can. The fire marshal says it's a hazard. The police say it's costing a fortune to police the place. Media types have stopped going into it because somebody got assaulted there last week. So we'll see how it goes. The courts in British Columbia have taken a dim view of these actions because the judges go, well, where are they going to go? Like, are you just going to move the problem to another vacant lot somewhere, or are you actually going to solve it? And I guess the only reply to that, Bill, is what I said earlier. Has anybody, even with the best of intentions, been able to solve this problem?
Well, we talk a lot about how Seattle and King County are trying to solve it, trying to help people without shelter. What are some of the hopeful things that you're doing in Greater Vancouver?
Well, they put an awful lot of money in it. The government, we estimate down in the region where most of the homeless are, spending about $1 million a day on public agencies of one kind or another. They've built a lot of social housing. As I said, the provincial government bought a dozen low-end hotels and converted them to single occupancy. Here in Victoria, they've bought a bunch of places and are moving people into it. But, you know, again, the other thing is the data the government gathers, Bill, again, this won't surprise people in other cities on the West Coast, shows that we import people from other parts of the country. And that's because our climate, as I say, allows people to live on the street, not always in relative comfort, but I guess compared to the eastern climate, it is a little bit better. So, you know, you want to be careful what you say on it. You don't want to suggest that it's beyond solution. But I think most of the politicians that have walked into this issue, Bill, in this country now realize that it's a heck of a lot more complicated than you think. It is not just a problem that you need to throw more money at it. And even with the best of intentions, you can end up like the mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, who promised to get rid of the problem and is now finding homelessness at record numbers.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer talking with Bill Radke. There's a new player in Seattle's affordable housing game. For 25 years, the environmental group Forterra has been buying up undeveloped land and farms and forests around the Puget Sound. Now they're working with El Centro de la Raza to preserve Seattle's apartment complexes. Jean Duvernoy, the president and CEO of Forterra, and Estella Ortega, executive director of El Centro de la Raza, joined us to explain how this will work. Jeannie Yandel first asked Jean, what does building affordable housing have to do with saving the environment?
Oh, that's a question we've been asked a lot. And when you think about it, it's really apparent. If we want to really save our environment, that means we have to make a place where people celebrate living, where everyone can lead a life of dignity. Another word for that is cities. So we need to open up our cities and make them inclusive. Otherwise, we sprawl. And we lose our woods, we lose our streams. So it's both.
How does this project work? What will Forterra be doing?
Well, first we're going to partner with world-class organizations like El Centro de la Raza and work with them to identify the properties in their communities and catchment areas that are available and can be acquired and held on to till that community-based organization is ready to develop that site for housing. So our aim is to work with great partners like El Centro to improve a neighborhood, but not gentrify a neighborhood.
I bet you've been asked this question as well. Where does the money come from for this?
Yeah, I have been asked that question. There's all sorts of sources for money. We have worked in this community for three decades now. We live in a very progressive community, and what we have discovered are that there are individuals and partners who have done well in this community, who are willing to reinvest in this community, and they will be our partners.
And Estella, as the executive director of El Centro de la Raza, what problems does this solve for your organization?
Well, it obviously solves people being pushed out of the cities, and we can see that every day when, you know, our freeways are all clogged up. Many of our people are living in South County. In fact, 51% of Latinos live in South County because it's no longer affordable to live in the city. I was having a conversation yesterday with an elementary student that's in the third grade, and he was asking me, you know, what I did. And obviously, I was talking about Plaza Roberto Maestas. And I gave an example of an article that I had read earlier that day that one-bedroom apartments were now renting for $1,750. And this little boy pipes up and he says, yes, you know, we used to live around here and our rent was very expensive. And now we live in Federal Way and we pay $650 a month for rent. So here was, you know, an 8-year-old, very cognizant also. And his family was having to trek all the way from Federal Way to go to school in Seattle. And obviously the parents worked in the city. And so, you know, there's many issues around that, from, you know, the freeways are being clogged up to the quality of time, you know, that they're spending in their cars.
And you mentioned Plaza Roberto Maestas. That's an affordable housing project that your organization has already been working on. How will a partnership with Forterra make it easier for you to start a project like that next time?
Well, obviously, right now, as we know, land is being bought up left and right in our city. You know, people are coming in from different states, different countries to purchase land because Seattle is a wonderful place to live in. And if we don't move fast and look at the opportunities that are there, the land is no longer going to be there. And then we're going to miss an opportunity to ensure that our city is diverse, that we're developing housing. And as Mayor Murray has said, that people who work in our city deserve to live in the same city.
Jean, you announced that Forterra was going to start looking for parcels of land for building affordable housing in the city at a fundraiser. You announced that change at a fundraiser. What kind of response did you get from the people who were attending the fundraiser?
Oh, that was interesting. Basically comes down to, if you want to save the woods, build a great city. And I would split our audience at that fundraiser into two groups. The first group, who has been working with this for many years, understood that immediately, that a sustainable city has to be sustainable for everyone, not just those of us who have high-paying jobs. The second group, who has been working with us and understood how we need to conserve our woods, frankly got very quiet. And I think Estella noticed that too. They got very quiet and were listening very intently. And now it's our job to really be a thought leader and bring them along and have everyone understand that if we're going to have a sustainable region, it needs to be inclusive and be sustainable from the top of our mountains into our cities.
I'm going to pretend for a moment that I was one of the attendees of that fundraiser who was listening very intently. And I was listening because I am not quite convinced yet that I care about the issue of affordable housing, but I do care very deeply about preserving the woods. So, Jean, how do you convince me to get on board with the other side of this?
Well, clearly I haven't quite convinced you yet, so let me try again. First, I think we can all agree we don't want to have the problems that San Francisco has. That is a problem that comes from affordability. That is a city that is at great debate within itself because it can no longer afford to have its original citizens live there. So for us, it's we've learned from that. Let's make Seattle something different, and let's recognize that our woods and our forests and streams are only what they are if we don't inhabit them. So let's create a great place where we can all live, all of us live, and all of us can afford to live. Otherwise, we will sprawl into those very places we're trying to save.
I feel like I've heard a couple of buzzwords in these discussions over time about what Seattle should look like as a place where more people are coming, where it's becoming more expensive. I've heard the words urbanism, and I've heard the words density. You did not just use those words when you made your pitch to me about why I should care. Do you do that on purpose, avoid those buzzwords?
Well, a little bit. Last time I used the word density with any frequency, I was in geometry, and I didn't get a very good grade in geometry. So those are words that don't speak to anyone. But inclusive neighborhoods, room for your kids and your neighbors. Let's talk about the human element. Face-to-face in a way we all understand.
Estella, when you talk with people who support Centro de la Raza about this, what kind of response are you getting? What are people saying to you about this idea?
Well, I'll just speak from the perspective of the neighborhood, because we know that sometimes neighborhoods, when they hear that there's affordable housing, they're not happy about it. And so on Beacon Hill, what we did to ensure that our neighbors were walking side by side with us is that we had more than 30 meetings to, you know, get their input about zoning, how high should we go, what kind of development should we have there. And the community was extremely supportive. And the reason is that it wasn't just a place, if I could just say, for poor people, affordable housing for them, but we were developing a community where there was, they could bring their children to the child care center that we were going, that's going to be a part of the development. There's a cultural center. There's restaurants. There's going to be movies in the evenings during the summer. So they see themselves in there, and the neighborhood can hardly wait for the development to be done. Because what we've done, it's not just a question of affordable housing, but we're creating community that is for everyone.
I've got one last question. Part of your job, Jean, is to take the long view on things. So 100 years from now, do you think that anybody will look back and notice that an environmental organization in the Puget Sound region started to bank land for affordable housing?
That would be...
I'm asking you to take out a crystal ball, basically, yeah, and make a prediction.
And my crystal ball is extraordinarily cloudy. What I hope is 100 years from now, people will look back and say that this generation, these folks living in Seattle today, got it right about how to create a great community that's very inclusive. I sit and I listen to Estella, and I recognize that sustainability is about both the social and the environmental. And Estella presents my arguments better than I do. And that's how I get grave hope that we will, in fact, have a sustainable region.
That's Jean Duvernoy, president and CEO of Forterra, and Estella Ortega, executive director of El Centro de la Raza. They spoke with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel.